everybody. Welcome back to the podcast, Raya Affairs. I'm Francia Morales. I'm your host, as well as the editor-in-chief of the research and analysis team here at Raya. And Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind-the-scenes of decision-makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As we always do in all of our episodes, I have to give a really quick disclaimer that expressed opinions in this episode are welcome, even if they are not a direct reflection of our company, as we specialize in unbiased writing. And you can find all of these writings in riagroup.org. In today's episode, we'll be focusing on Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, with Chiara Leorato, one of our interns this term. Chiara, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Francia. Thank you very much for the introduction. I am Chiara Leorato. I am a student of international relations, doing my master's right now in the Sant'Anna School of Advanced Studies in Italy. And I'm an intern with Raya, and since this January I started analyzing writing articles for Raya, and I'm very excited to be here in this program podcast with you.
Very nice. Thank you so much for your introduction. So, Chiara, I hope that you saw during your preparation that we do a bit of an icebreaker before we begin, just to kind of get you used to talking a bit in the podcast and you don't feel so nervous about the harder questions. So we like to do a bit of an intro question, which is probably everyone's most heard question. But if you could choose, could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world, would you want to have a conversation or a dinner with?
Okay, so this could be a little bit biased because I'm Italian, but if I had a chance, I would pick Andreotti, which is a leader of like the First Republic, so in the 60s, from the 60s till the 80s in Italy, which had really important relations with the US during the Cold War, and Italy being a so difficult country because of the important ties it had to the with the Communist Party, but at the same time being for 30 years governed by a conservative party, had important ties with the US, and he was with strange relations with both terrorists and mafia groups, but he was never found guilty. So I would love to have dinner with him and just ask what happened in this country for 30 years.
Very nice. That's a very interesting answer. I'm always happy when people choose someone from their own country because you get to find out a little bit of the lore that I think people will have when they're closer to a political situation than when they're outside of the country. Very interesting answer, Chiara. Now that you've had good practice, we can move on to the more difficult questions. So you recently wrote an article about Modi, who is facing elections this year. And I'm just going to ask you a bit of questions about your article so you can maybe tell our listeners a bit more about it. And then maybe, hopefully, they'll be inclined to go read it. So elections are happening in India. India is the biggest democracy on earth. They have about 1.4 billion people, and some interesting things have been happening over the past decade now. So what is the situation looking like on the ground right now for Indian elections? Who are the parties? Who's running? Who's maybe not running? And who is set to win, do you think?
Well, there is the big favorite one, so the Bharatiya Janata's party, which is Modi's party, that is in charge till 2014, so already a decade, which is prospected to win the elections. Most of the polls depict the BJP as the most probable winner of the election. And on the other hand, other 28 parties, so a real huge number of parties, united into a coalition which is called the Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance. And they united together in order to contrast the BJP and the Modi in general. But it is really difficult for me to say who between the two can be really the favorite in this next elections. What we can say is that recently the BJP has won in two states, the Rajasthan and the Chhattisgarh, which were traditionally led by the Congress Party, and the Congress Party is another party that probably will not have this much success in this year's elections, because it is the most traditional party of India, the one of Nehru, and it had governed India for the second half of the 20th century, but now is internally divided and weakened by a lot of accuse of dynasty, nepotism and corruption. So it has lost a lot of legitimacy and support throughout India. And the support has been gained by the BJP. We just have to wait for the election to understand whether this India coalition will be able to contrast the BJP and Modi on things like the employment or the media freedom or the social tensions. But so far, this coalition seems really variegated, not to say with an unclear political agenda. And the most encouraging part for this coalition is that they were not able to find a political leader that could contrast Modi on a political level.
Wow, that's so interesting. And I think that we see that pattern sometimes in national politics with a figure that's as strong as Modi. When opposition parties try to band together, it doesn't necessarily mean that all of the opposition parties agree with each other about how to oppose the incumbent. So in the likely case that Modi wins a third term, this would mark his 10th year in power, which is not uncommon in India to have long tenures, but this would mark his 10th year. In the case that he wins a third term, do you believe that there's a possibility for the India coalition to at least gain any significant power in parliament? And would this be a constraint for Modi going forward?
Well, this is really, really difficult to say because it depends a lot on how the election will go. And especially in the last decade worldwide, it is really difficult to predict how election will go. But we do can pay attention to both the recent polls, and the recent polls saying that the BJP is like so much seen as the winner. It is really difficult to see a significant power in the hand of the India coalition, because polls say that for the 80% of people, the BJP is the most favorable one. And in the other end, instead, we could look at how the voting system is structured to understand how the election could go. And in India, there is a simple majority voting, meaning that the person that gains the more votes just becomes elected. So it depends a lot on the sustain that the coalition or the BJP have in different electoral zones. And the situation so far is that if we look at the different states of the Indian Federation, almost half of them are governed by the BJP. So if the India coalition can have a power, it's going to be for sure a minority one. I cannot say how much, but if it can, just a minority one, because of the combination of the voting system and the situation on the ground so far.
Wow, thank you. I'm going to move ahead to a bit of the MO of the BJP, and in particular Modi. So just for our listeners to know, India has one of the largest Muslim populations in the world. It is behind only Pakistan and Indonesia, that are both pretty big Muslim countries. And still, with 200 million Muslims, the Muslim population of India makes up roughly 14 to 15% of the population. This is due to a lot of historical factors, the partition of the British Mandate in India, and a lot of struggle, war, and ultimately a lot of Muslims fleeing India during the 20th century. But now we're seeing that Modi has ramped up rhetoric, well, since he began running, but he has ramped up rhetoric against India's Muslims. And help us understand, why does he do this? And if you could tell us in sort of a few sentences, why do you think this has been so successful for him, knowing now that he is going for his third term with probably the most support that he's ever had?
Well, in India, there is a century-long conflict between Hindus and Muslim. So looking at the more historical context, we can see how this problem is not only a nowadays problem, but a conflict that is intrinsic to Indian history. And instead, if we look at Modi in particular, we can see how he has always been part of organizations or parties that sustained a Hindu-only India. So sustaining how in India's past Hindus were the majority or the most important ones, to put in a blunt way, and all the organizations that and parties that Modi has been part of sooner or later have been involved in attacks under Muslim population, not to talk about all the narratives and discourses against the Muslim population. And looking in details at Modi's political career, there is one event that has been very problematic for him, because in 2002, when he was the governor of the Gujarat region, pogrom, we can call it this way, has been performed against Muslims. So more than 1,000 Muslims were killed by Hindus when they were coming back from prayer. And he almost did nothing, and no one was found guilty, notwithstanding the entity of the attack. And since he has been prime minister, so in the last decade, analysis says that hate crimes against Muslim minorities have increased almost by the 300%. So we can see how he has a really impactful approach to the social and religious discrimination and the polarization between the two groups.
But I feel like there's no right way to approach a question to say, can this be fixed or can it not be fixed, knowing the depth of the issue and how far back it goes. And the idea that the last time that you had resentments to this level, you had a quite literal war that created a whole new state that both Hindus and Muslims had to be running away from. So you had a mass migration of Hindus from Pakistan and then a mass migration of Muslims from India into Pakistan. And so I wish there were a better way to approach the topic and say, okay, what's our hope for the future? But we can only hope that the court sustained the constitutional rights of all Indians. And we know that that has been happening in some instances where the courts have rejected some of the policies that Modi has put out, but they've also sustained, for example, the revocation of Kashmiri autonomy or the special status of Kashmir quite recently. So I believe it was this December that you wrote that a decision of a court sustained Modi's decision to revoke Kashmiri special status. How does this affect relations with Pakistan? How does this affect the lives of the people in Kashmir who sometimes live in a bit of an international relations limbo?
The Kashmir region is the region both claimed by both India and Pakistan, and it's the region where most of the violent attacks have take place since India's independence. And basically, after the war that partitioned India and Pakistan, this region, which is a majority of Muslim people, was given some kind of special autonomy, real important autonomy, in order to avoid conflicts and avoid basically all the atrocities that happened into that 2 years war. With time, tensions just sometimes arose again, and the most relevant one was the one in 1999 between the two states. But all over this time, in the Kashmir region, there has been a lot of insurgencies and protests against what has been perceived by Kashmiri people as discrimination by the Indian government. And on the other hand, instead, India depicted these upsprings as caused, in a sense, created, sustained by Pakistan. And the withdrawal of the autonomy in 2019, so already 5 years ago, can be seen as a way to exert more control on the region, so to give less autonomy and liberty to those people in order to avoid them to create, in a sense, in a certain way, problems for the Indian government, and to also tell Pakistan that India has a sovereignty over that place and has control over over that region. And of course, action worsened and rendered even more frozen the relations between India and Pakistan, which were already well frozen. And just 3 months ago, the Indian Supreme Court confirmed the legality of such an act, saying that the article in the constitution that created this autonomy was intended just to allow a smooth inclusion of the region in the newly independent Indian state. But this situation was not present anymore, even if the inclusion in the state, at least from my analyst perspective, has not been smooth, has not been resolved, because otherwise these conflicts and tension would not have been there anymore. And I think the most problematic part is the violence that then has been exercised by the Indian military forces in the Kashmir region. This created more frozen relations between India and Pakistan. This didn't escalate to a conflict, probably because Pakistan is just too worried and busy with its own internal situation, or because they both have nuclear weapons and so they deter each other from attacking. There are different ways of trying to explain this non-violent attack. For sure, we are happy that it hasn't occurred. The relations are very, very, very problematic right now.
Okay. And with this, actually, with the revocation of the autonomous region status of Kashmir, the BJP actually accomplishes two of its three main goals that I believe they set out in like 2002 or something to that effect. And it was both this and then the recently unveiled Hindu temple in Ayodhya, which was extremely significant. It was a site in which a previous mosque had been demolished, and other Indian leaders had denounced the demolition of that mosque in order to show some sort of solidarity with the Muslim minority. But now Modi has endorsed this view that Hinduism prevails or predates and therefore is superior to Islam in India, right? So do you believe that there is any possibility that Modi will use his third term, sort of a more concrete amalgamation of power, to accomplish the third goal, which is, I believe, to create a unified civil code with no exceptions for Muslims? I know that in India, Muslims have separate laws or regulations regarding marriage and things like that. So do you think that he will further erase this difference, not in the search for a secular Indian state, but a search for sort of a Hindu nationalist or Hindu supremacist India?
So, yes, the Unified Civil Code basically is a law that governs personal matters, as, for example, marriage, divorce, inheritance, and things like that, that applies in the same way to all Indian citizens, regardless of their religion. And it is important because so far these personal matters have been ruled by religious rules. So they were considered customary rules applying differently to different religious groups. So, for example, in the case of Muslim, the personal matters were ruled by the Sharia law. And you're completely right when saying that the approval of this law that has been approved indeed on the in February, so last month, by the federal parliament, and I think it has been ratified, adopted just in one state of the federation so far. But yeah, it is part of a broader agenda of Modi to create a Hindu supremacist India, because by creating unified rules among all the population, basically Modi is rendering impossible to Muslim people to respect the Sharia law, and so they have to adapt to what in practice are the rules for Hindu and for other other religious groups. And actually I think that this unified civil code will create a lot of debates, because on the one hand it creates it gives more rights to children and to women, because for example it sets a minimal age for wedding and abolish the polygamy, and gives equal rights to daughters and sons, so for every citizen of India. But in the other hand, it does limit the freedom of religion and of life of Muslim people. So on the one hand, we have some we have women's rights and children's rights, while on the other hand, we have freedom of religion. And both of them are human rights. So it's really difficult to assess how much this is going to benefit this part of the population, and how much instead this is going to ruin our already very inclined equilibrium in India.
Wow. Wow, that's so interesting. And that seems to be a lot of our debate, right? I know that in universities and all of these things, we have a lot of ongoing debate as to what extent do we enforce equality or enforce our interpretation of equality and of the world. And this is certainly a liberal value of everyone getting treated the same. That might not equate for every single group or thought. That might believe that there are simply roles to be played in society So this is very interesting. I think that it'll be interesting to see if states ratify it. I'm not entirely sure how ratification works in India, so I'm not sure if the law can then expire if not enough states ratified. I know that that's how it works in the United States, at least, but we'll see. And it is very interesting that it seems that Modi and his party have been entirely successful in all of the policies that they've been wanting to pass, and at the same time, they have been able to do so with pretty steady high economic growth. I know that right before the pandemic, this economic growth slumped, and then, of course, during the pandemic, it plummeted, but we see some high numbers now again. So, to finalize this episode, Kiera, I have one last question, which should be the most important to our listeners. How is the internal politics of India relevant to international relations? How do these movements or developments have an impact outside of Indian borders? This can be either regional or broadly global.
Well, yes, these events have an impact also in India's foreign relations, not to mention the relation with Pakistan, which we already went through, and so it's really way clear how the treatment of Muslim people has a role in its foreign policy. And this increasingly harsh treatment could, on the one hand, establish control and supremacy of Hindu people over Muslim. So, like, in a sense, in a very negative sense, resolve the social tension between the two groups. Or, in the other hand, the opposite can happen. So, conflict and tension can be exacerbated and so end up in an internal conflict. And since India is the most populated country in the world nowadays, this would for sure have an impact, at least in the neighboring states, in terms of movement of people, in terms of spreading of tensions. And given the entity of the Indian state, it could have an impact not only in the neighboring states, but in the broader region, and probably also to Europe. Europe so far has slightly criticized Modi for his attacks to human rights, but these were only critics by words, so no effective change into the relation with India has been performed by the EU. Or rather, in 2023, the EU tried to create a new trade corridor with India. So economically, we are sustaining still India, notwithstanding that we know the violations of human rights that are performed against the Muslim population. And these critics has come mainly from Europe and the more liberal countries, while for other countries, as for example Russia, this has almost no relevance, and Russia has really strict relations with India, mainly based on the selling of oil and selling of weapons, at the same time, it's of course very unlikely that Putin would criticize the violation of human rights, especially against Muslim people, because, I mean, let's look at what happened in Czechoslovakia in the last 30 years. So yes, the internal situation can, at least in theory, have an impact on the regional situation of Asia, and in case of an exacerbation of internal conflict, also in the broader area to China and to Europe. But so far, the situation at least seems under control. Let's see how the election goes and what will would happen afterwards. And on the matter of critics, it's only rhetoric from the liberal states, but nothing tangible.
I see. And yes, I mean, to qualify what you're saying, we have also seen some criticism from, I believe there's a, I forget the name now of the organization, but it's a Council of Arab States. And I believe there are quite a few number of Muslim states in that organization. And they have made criticisms of Modi and saying, you know, you must basically cease and desist your treatment of Indian Muslim citizens. And at the same time, we know that Modi is, let's say, economically popular with, in particular, the Gulf countries. I think it was in the UAE where he just unveiled a temple and he was invited to come. And this just speaks to the grand importance that India is amassing at the moment, because we expect, obviously, as you said, we don't really expect criticism from countries such as China or Russia, who also have their own qualms or reservations about their own Muslim population. But the countries that we do expect it from, so let's say Muslim countries, also give it only in rhetoric. We also see it only in the speech level, per se. So we can see and understand how important India is economically, how important the South Pacific region has become, and how it's not worth it to sully your relations with a leader who you will definitely need, as India is both a growing economy and an ever-growing workforce. And I think this is a great place to close our conversation. Chiara, this was so enlightening and so interesting. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. I certainly had so much fun. I hope that you also had fun talking to me.
Yes, I did a lot, to be honest. Thank you for the interview.
Thank you to all of our readers and our listeners for listening to today's episode. I must say once again that my name is Francia Morales. I am the RNA editor-in-chief, and with me was Chiara Leorato, who is one of our interns this term. You can read her article at riagroup.org and any of our other content, and you can listen to our podcast anywhere where you listen to podcasts. I hope you have a great rest of your week and a great rest of your day, and we'll see you in the next episode. Thank you.